You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Hello, welcome please to Telstra Customer Service. How may I be helping you?
Conform or be consumed.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history.
I heard a rumour today.
I like your rumours.
I know, as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school, how can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
What is your environmental policy?
To sell Telstra.
You heard of road rage?
Yes.
What about web rage?
And within a few minutes.
Minutes?
Yeah, minutes. It's not minutes. Next year, mate.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. Have you ever planned a trip overseas and wondered what technology is like on the other side of the world? Chances are, we take what we have in this country, along with other developed countries, for granted. That is, our existing mobile phone will roam on our hosts' networks. We'll still receive the plethora of SMS messages we receive daily, albeit at a slightly inflated price. And the internet is still a click away. But spare a thought for expats living in countries like Pakistan. Today, Dr. Ron chats with one just expat living in Islamabad. Apple have had their fair share in the media spotlight of late, but what of the great new products Steve Jobs promised us recently in the form of the Apple iPhone and Apple TV? Well, to this day, Australian telcos have dismissed the iPhone as yesterday's technology, and Apple TV has fallen off the radar because of the lack of content in the Australian market and the technology it connects with. Adam Turner put his feet up on the couch this week to compare apples with apples and found what looks delicious and inviting on the outside is more like a lemon on the inside. And if you're in the market for a box which does what Apple TV should do, then stay tuned to today's edition of the show. Aviation has been in the news for all the wrong reasons in recent times, what with the private equity buyout of Qantas falling in a heap and the tragic Air Garuda crash in Indonesia earlier this year. We thought it high time to get our regular aviation guru on the show to tell us about these and other goings-on in the high-tech world of aviation. Mark Mayer is a recently retired Qantas pilot and is passionate about flying, so stay tuned for the latest news in world aviation.
This week on Tech Talk Radio.
Lydia Davis talks Web 2.0 from Silicon Valley in the United States. Adam Turner looks at Apple TV. Mark Mayer returns to Tech Talk Radio to talk aviation. Telstra targets the ACCC over broadband. Amazon to tackle iTunes with DRM-free music later this year. And Google's Universal Search coming to a web browser near you. All that and more on Australia's premier tech talk show, Tech Talk Radio. But first, let's find out what's been making news in the tech world this week.
This is Tech Talk News.
This week on Tech Talk News, Telstra makes stealth upgrades to its cable network. Senator Coonan blasts computer game modelled on Virginia Tech Massacre. Apple's iPhone gets the FCC tick of approval. Dell starts shipping Ubuntu. And Microsoft's new document format, not popular in Europe. Welcome to Tech Talk News. The Age last week reported that Telstra has been quietly testing a significant upgrade to its existing cable broadband network. A select group of Telstra staff has been afforded the opportunity to trial a new technology for the cable network, offering a significantly better broadband experience than what's currently available to subscribers. The news comes amidst daily distractions of Telstra's tit-for-tat broadband battle with the ACCC. The upgrade apparently involves a speed boost that would allow Telstra's cable network to support so-called triple play functionality, that is, the use of simultaneous applications like video on demand, voice and video over broadband, and high-definition broadcast television. Australian IT noted that during the launch of its NextG network in October last year, Telstra revealed that it was committing $60 million to a cable network upgrade. This upgrade was intended to ready the network for the DOCSIS 3 cable standard, enabling an increase from the current 17 megabits per second to a potential 160 megabits per second. Users would be required to install a new cable modem to take advantage of the speed increase on a DOCSIS 3 network. A Telstra spokesman declined requests by The Age last week to comment on the upgrade. Communications Minister, Senator the Honourable Helen Coonan, has asked the ACMA to intervene in the distribution of an online game. VTech Rampage is based on the Virginia Tech massacre and was created by a 21-year-old Sydney man who moved to Australia from the United States when he was 14. Senator Coonan last week said the game was in very poor taste and suggested the Sydney man seek professional help. VTech Rampage features a character based on the gunman who last month shot and killed 32 students at the Virginia Tech campus in the United States. While the ACMA can move to have hosting sites blacklisted if the game is found to be in breach of the government's online content scheme, the ban will only work where specific types of internet filtering software are being used by ISPs. Senator Coonan's comments and actions were supported by New South Wales Police Minister David Campbell, who said, "This computer game is absolutely disgusting in its celebration of a tragic mass murder." The creator of the game was unrepentant, and despite the closure of his website by an offshore ISP, the game is still available on other hosting sites. Apple's much-anticipated iPhone received the tick of approval last week from United States government regulators at the Federal Communications Commission. Apple spokesperson Natalie Kerris said the iPhone has passed its required FCC certification and is on schedule to ship in late June as planned. FCC documentation has confirmed some features of the iPhone, including Bluetooth and Wi-Fi functionality and dual-band GSM network connectivity. The iPhone will use the low-speed GPRS data standard. There's no news as yet of a 3G-compatible iPhone. In a slap in the face for Microsoft Corporation, hardware manufacturer Dell has recently announced a line of PCs and servers preloaded with the Ubuntu operating system. Ubuntu is a popular distribution of the free Debian Linux operating system. Ubuntu is also open source, meaning developers can freely access the operating system, make changes, and write their own applications without the need for expensive development kits and licensing. Dell spokesman Jeremy Bolin said that Dell plans to start offering Ubuntu as an option on selected consumer PCs in coming weeks, and that machines pre-installed with Ubuntu will be less expensive than PCs of the same configuration that come with Windows. Industry analysts have praised Dell for the initiative, but warned that many programs are written specifically for Windows and aren't yet available for Linux. And in more bad news for Microsoft this week, a new document format launched by the software giant has received a cold reception by the European business market. Many European countries, such as France, Denmark, Germany, and Holland, have recently mandated the use of open document formats, such as ODF and PDF, for use in government agencies. So Microsoft's proprietary Office Open XML, or OOXML format, has consequently left IT analysts scratching their heads. Coincidentally, 2 weeks ago in the United States, California introduced legislation to make non-proprietary open document formats, like ODF and PDF, a mandatory requirement for government agencies acquiring software. Analysts believe that Microsoft is under increasing pressure in an effort to convince users to upgrade to its new operating system, Vista, and its new Office suite, Office 2007. Both of these involve considerable expense, especially to government agencies needing hundreds or sometimes thousands of client licenses. Products like OpenOffice, which support the non-proprietary ODF and PDF standards, are distributed free of charge. And that's your tech update for this week.
Previously on Tech Talk Radio.
Telcos are holding us back. Did you know that?
Graham appears surprised.
Yeah. The other thing too, there was a bit of a faux pas this week. I don't know whether you caught on with what happened on Telstra's Now We're Not Talking website.
Oh, yes, one of those socially awkward moments.
Yes, it was.
You miss one episode, so you go and download that episode, and then you realise that, hang on, the rest of the series is here and we haven't seen any of it yet. I'll download all those as well.
You do not have to be running a Linux-based system to use OpenOffice.
No, I've got OpenOffice.org installed on my Windows machine and it runs really nicely.
They've had a case of the Pandoras, haven't they?
They have had a case of the Pandoras.
This buzz that everybody's starting to play with is something called SDR, or Software Defined Radios. And the stuff that you were experimenting with back then continues today, but it's been enhanced even further.
That's part of the romantic days when ships were at sea and all that sort of stuff. Right. So
how was the King digitally altered?
Doesn't say here.
I'd rather not know, to be honest.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And hello there, everybody. Welcome to today's edition of Tech Talk Radio. Oh, and lots has been happening again, as per normal in the tech world, especially in the genre of telecommunications and broadband, but to that later. Graham Callaghan, good evening. How are you?
Well, Andrew, good evening.
And Dr. Ron is not here tonight. He's on vacation, but he did give a note last week. So we've got Mark Mayer, who has popped in to fill the shoes of Dr. Ron. Good evening, Mark. How are you?
Good evening, Andrew. I'm well, thank you.
We're going to talk aviation with you very shortly. But in the meanwhile, feel free to contribute and add to the show that is Tech Talk Radio for all its jocularity and the like.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
But you've been here before. You're well experienced.
Yes, it's great to be back.
Yes. All right. Graham, any exciting news that's jumped out in the press or something this week since we've last been on the radio?
Well, just one thing that I will mention is I've noticed that there's been more dramas with Microsoft updates.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This is the Patch Tuesday that comes out and sort of...
Yeah, the Windows updates that go on. I've had a fight in the last week with a couple of machines that just went really, really slow after doing a Windows update.
Oh, that's not uncommon, is it?
No, well, this was really slow.
Oh, slower than normal?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, CPU usage, approaching 100% on a single CPU system.
Oh, yeah.
Or approaching 50% on a dual CPU system, and that was really quite frustrating for a while. Turns out that Microsoft does have updates to fix it, but it was having trouble.
A patch for the patch. Yeah, that happened a while back with a sound card device the laptops where... They brought out a patch and nothing would work sound card wise, or kept throwing up funny DLL errors or something like
exactly
that.
Exactly right, and there was a patch to fix that, and there was a patch to fix the fault that I was chasing, but because the machine was running so slowly, it was taking it far too long to actually get it happening. And I was just reading in the news today that there's another one going on with Internet Explorer 7 as the result of one of their patches on some systems, in particular on Vista systems, but also in some circumstances on XP systems, I believe, just throwing an error and failing to start.
Oh, that's a problem. Well, so you can't even turn your machine on?
No, you can't start your web browser.
Oh.
So Internet Explorer 7 won't start.
So you can't log on to... download the patch. You have to go onto another machine, download the patch, copy it across on your memory stick or the network.
Something like that. So I haven't read all the details about the fix. There's certainly ways to work around it. If you're having that problem, what I'd suggest is go to another machine and let us know about it on the forum.
Or buy a Mac.
Or buy a Mac.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. No, don't buy Macs. They're going back in their droves at the moment. Yes.
We'll hear about that later. But and on the forum, we'll be able to talk you through getting out of whatever your particular drama is.
Good point. Forum.techtalkradio.com.au. And while we're talking about Microsoft, they've been on the out doing a bit of shopping and trying to keep up with the behemoth that is Google. Microsoft has bought a Aquantive for $6 billion US.
Now, they bought a what?
Yeah, they bought this company called Aquantive. Now, what these guys do is where Microsoft's deficiencies are. Basically, they specialize in online marketing. You know, like what Google does with AdWords, these guys can do in their online marketing, because this is where the money's going to be in the future from both and advertisers and, television and radio. They're by the by these days. Nowadays, it's advertising online. And you've seen all the rubbish that gets thrown at you when you go to, a newspaper site or something like that.
Oh,
all
absolutely,
those ads.
Yes.
Because Google recently bought DoubleClick, which is an advertising agency type sort of internet ad agency thing in itself. And now Microsoft has to try and keep up appearances, and they've bought these guys. And they also run an advertising agency as well. So maybe this will strengthen Microsoft's bow a little bit in the world of online.
It'll be interesting to see what changes there are around the MSN website.
Well, it will. It will. I just don't think they've... They haven't had much luck of late, poor old Microsoft.
And no, they haven't.
I think hopefully they haven't left the gate open, if you know what I mean, and the horse hasn't bolted too far. Anyway, broadband, that's big in the news this week too.
Yep,
there's
always is these days, isn't it?
Yeah, I got an email from a listener this week who, unfortunately, I forgot to bring it into the studio tonight, and you'll know who you are out there. She was an expat. No, she wasn't an expat. She was living in Canada listening to us on the pod and said, I haven't listened to your show for 6 months, but I've come back and it's lost some of the international feel. And I thought, have we lost some of our international feel?
We should just put on some really sexy accents then.
Okay, we could do that.
Yeah.
But we've had some good Russian accents in here. I don't know whether you heard. We had Eugene Kaspersky on recently, and he was good. And we're doing a fair bit more in the United States, thanks to Lydia. She's out there doing stuff as well. So,
but I suspect that we've been talking a fair bit about the local broadband scene.
Our domestic issues are really paramount at the moment, aren't they?
And I'm hoping that our international listeners will bear with us for that. set, because it's very important to us here in Australia at the moment because of the upcoming election, which
that's
is
what I said on their email back,
which we're looking forward to later this year. And once that's over, hopefully we'll be able to concentrate a bit more on
well,
on
the bottom line is with this election, we're going to have a major decision in this country about the future of broadband.
Yep.
And they've been talking up, the government wants 12 megabits per second. But the bottom line is that we've got so much spin out there clouding the issues with what Telstra say, with what G9 say, which what T4 say, which what Coonan says, what the ACCC says. Consumers at the moment are going, where do we start? They just don't know what it is. But the bottom line is we've got this election coming up. My bet is the first weekend in November. If anyone wants to put, we should have a little lotto in here, shouldn't we? Pick the weekend for the election. We did well like that. But I reckon that's when the election will be. But the decision on broadband, is it going to be based on someone's short-term political future, or is it going to be based on an educated decision for the country's well-being beyond this next election? There's the question.
I think you know the answer to that question.
We have compulsory voting in this country, so I think that answers the question, doesn't it, Andy?
Thank you. Thank you. Now, that in itself is scary, isn't it? So please forgive us if we talk a little bit about broadband in this country, but we've got to speak now before the election so that everyone can get out there and do it. We will try in due course to actually have some conversations with said ministers and those people in those political environments too. So watch this space. There's some great articles too in the mainstream press, which we'll refer to a few of those later up too, about Telstra coming up shortly. So,
okay.
In the meanwhile, AMD. Graham, are you an AMD processor man, or are you an Intel man?
Oh, I'm edging towards being an Intel sort of a guy. I tend to a little bit conservative in my tastes sometimes.
Are you?
Yeah.
You just like the Intel brand, do you?
Yeah, I think so.
AMD has unveiled a Puma laptop platform. Did you hear about this?
I did read something about this, yeah.
Okay, this is because AMD's been sort of the second fiddle for a long time. They're actually now starting to give Intel a run for their money when it comes to processors. AMD has detailed on plans for its first chip platform designed specifically for notebook personal computers. The platform, a collection of microprocessors, graphic chips, and other chips, is aimed at improving battery life and enhancing graphics and video processing performance. Here's to laptops, because I've got my laptop here running at the moment, so if you'd like to email me, feedback@techtalkradio.com.au. It'll pop up on the screen here. But battery life on laptops has always been an issue because, let's face it, you're lucky to get an hour, and especially if you're like me, you want the screen bright so you can see what you're doing in a bright environment.
That's part of the problem, of course, because it does depend on exactly what you're doing. And if you do have the screen bright and you've got lots of activity and you're playing video or you're running your CD-ROM or anything like that, you're going to chew up your battery.
But if you stick your hand out the back
or
there,
if you're running Vista, for that matter.
Well, there's another point, and I'll come back to that. If you stick your hand out the back of a laptop, how hot do they run?
That's amazing.
I reckon
how hot
I
they get.
Cook something out the back of the little van that comes out of this little compact that I've got here. So, but anyway, now just a quick straw poll, because you mentioned Vista.
Yes.
Do you know anyone who runs it?
Yes.
We're now 4 months down from the launch. Who? How many? Can you count them on one hand?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So this is getting back to our discussion with Microsoft. What is it that is fundamentally wrong why people don't take up this new technology when it's offered?
I think in Vista's case, it's sensible to not take it up until you actually replace your computer. The advantages that you're going to get out of Vista are only going to be realizable on very fast, very modern computers. Mm. So there's no point upgrading your existing computer to Vista. You're better off buying a new computer and getting Vista with it, and it'll be cheaper that way as well.
Yeah. What do you,
that's
Mark?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
You're an XP man?
Currently. Friends of ours, the D-Rollies, they've just got one of the Vistas. One of those nice ones you put on the table that folds up and looks like a little clock on the side. I can't remember what that's called.
Are we talking computers?
It's a computer laptop. Yeah,
oh, really?
But it's a desktop laptop. You know, the hybrid ones? And it's got Vista in it. And it looks really, really nice. It looks beautiful, but yes.
Is it fully functional? Because that's half the problem.
I believe it is, but I'm not sure they know all the features yet.
They must have spent big
bucks. It's the only person I know. But yes, buying on your computer is the only way I'd do it too.
Yeah. Because Dell have gone back. They've rolled back the clock, so to speak. You can now buy your computer with either Vista or XP preloaded. And I think they're even actually looking at Ubuntu. One of the major manufacturers, Dell, I think you can now, if you really want to cut the price of your computer purchase and you don't want the mainstream Windows product, you can now opt for an Ubuntu installation. That'll please Dr. Ron end.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Ron uses Ubuntu as his main desktop these days, and it really does prove that the technology is right up there. There's not a lot that he can't do on his Ubuntu machine. Ubuntu being a type of Linux, by the way.
Yeah, it is. On the Debian system.
Yeah.
Yeah, the free word. Also, Dell got sued over bait and switching ads and things like that. A bit misleading. Naughty, naughty Mr. Dell.
Yes.
So that also made the mainstream press this weekend. So, but yeah, I think Ubuntu's got half a chance, but I think one of the things we're discussing amongst colleagues was the fact that Ubuntu, you need to configure, not everything out of the box works with Ubuntu. You have to sort of like get it to work. But no, I might be wrong in that respect. Whereas,
well, I think it's getting better in that respect than Linux distributions used to be. And there's a lot of stuff that will work out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Dr. Ron's really the expert on that.
He
so
is.
We might have to
we'll
have
talk to him about
have
it
a chat
week.
With him about it. Yeah,
I do know that he'd failed to update. You know, the Windows updates you spoke of at the top of the show.
Yeah,
he failed to do that for about a year on one of his computers, and he's paying the price severely at the moment. He put his machine on and it wanted to download something like 1600
patches.
So it is worthwhile actually doing that patch every so often if you're connected yes. to the internet. Just do it once in once a month at least, and at least that way
turn it to be fully automatic. Seriously,
yeah. And then when you do the patch, when you do a big mass upgrade like Dr. Ron is, you don't have to debug 1600 patches. You just yeah. debug one or two something's gone wrong.
I do the automatic, but I had a problem with mine and came up and said I had a fake version of Windows, which obviously wasn't because I bought my Toshiba.
Oh, a non-genuine one.
Non-genuine. Yeah. It said it was non-genuine, and then I had to ring up Windows and they said, oh, well, we just have to check this, and then I had to go through a whole procedure to get it validated as genuine.
Okay, but they were able to help you on the phone and get it sorted
eventually,
out?
Eventually.
How long? Was it one of those hour-and-a-half calls?
Probably
Microsoft?
About one-hour-and-a-half calls.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was really
just
annoying.
Just as well, they got a 1-800 number, I think.
And so therefore, it was 1-800, yeah. which was good. But then I wanted to actually choose to when I do my upgrades, because you know how you can choose it just to automatically do it, and then just switches your computer off and restarts automatically.
That's right, 3 a.m. by default, but you can set that time to any time you like.
True, I suppose, yeah, that'd be better.
3 a.m. is good for doing an upgrade.
Often gets me at 3 a.m., I can tell you that.
But the genuine one was really annoying because you know you've got genuine if you've got it, so you don't need to be validated, do you?
Dr. Ron had this problem
He
too,
did have a problem with one of his machines, yeah. So
I don't know what he did with it.
It does occasionally misfire, that genuine validation thing.
Yeah, genuine validation, you know.
All right, let's talk Telstra briefly. Well, actually, it might not be too briefly. Telstra appeal was rejected. Business and consumers have been spared a rise in broadband charges after Telstra suffered another loss to the competition regulator. And boy, are they getting their Mr. Phil Burgess is really getting his nose out of joint these days. But the Australian Competition Tribunal yesterday, which was last week, threw out an appeal by the company against the competition regulator ruling on prices for its copper network. Telstra wanted to charge rivals a national average price of $30 a subscriber for access to the network, in conflict with the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, which wanted charges varied according to geographical regions of the service was being supplied to. So once again, Telstra have been told no in the interest of competition and fairness to consumers. The ACCC has won again by the sounds of it. So
yep.
What would you think the reaction would be? Take their $4.1 billion bat and ball and Phil Burgess has gone off again? He'll come back. He always does.
Yes. If you think about what that would do to broadband pricing, I mean, there's plenty of ADSL plans for less than $30
exactly
per month. So that would send the prices quite sharply if that got through.
And if you think about it too, we have telephone lines at home. Mm. Now, I don't know, I think I pay about $30 a month line rental.
That's right, yeah.
And then if you think Telstra get that, and then they get another $30 a month line rental for access for my broadband, they're getting $60 a month whack.
Yep.
For providing the copper, which, mind you, has never been upgraded in the time that I know from my telephone exchange to my house.
Back in the PMG.
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure they've still got all sorts of things between us and them and all those little poles in the street, but that's what we're paying $60 a month for if they got their way there. So I think the ACCC, you've got to bear in mind, they are working for us as opposed to others. Now, yes. Senator Coonan challenged the OECD broadband stats the other day. The OECD basically came out and said, hey, you're not doing too good. But Senator Coonan came out and she was concerned about the methodology that the OECD had adopted to compile a report which is used to rank broadband telecommunications infrastructure around the world.
Hmm.
Is this spilt milk too? Like, what is going on here?
I think that, with all due respect to Senator Coonan, that she might have more important things to worry about at the moment.
Well, exactly. She said she shared her concerns with other countries, including the United States, which has already written to the OECD to complain about their per-subscriber methodology when it comes to monitoring and surveying internet users and things like that. But really, we're sitting at number 17, I think, on the top list of ISPs and things like that. So, yeah, who knows?
Hmm.
This is what I mean. We're coming up to an election, folks. And
that's what I was just about to say that. Excellent again, first week of November.
And yes. And the G9 is about to release its speedy net plan. It's getting closer. So, you know, that's all just going to hit the table very shortly. But in the meanwhile, there's nothing like a bit of spilt milk to complain about. And this sort of summarizes, you know, because Telstra is getting it. I was compiling a little thing for the radio show the other day, and ACDC's Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap came to mind, so couldn't resist this.
In the true sense of the AC/DC song, Telstra have taken to Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap as it steps up its attack on the competition watchdog, the ACCC, accusing it of being a rogue agency that's holding back the rollout of high-speed broadband in Australia. Dirty Deeds! The giant telco has also challenged the government as it seeks approval to build a $4 billion high-speed network, and last week it took out full-page newspaper advertisements in every capital city as part of its campaign having a go at the ACCC.
The ACCC has put a heavy tag on broadband in this country. Help us lay a tackle on the regulator so Australia can kick some broadband goals.
The attack from Phil Burgess, Telstra's public policy chief, is reaching fever pitch.
The government has to decide whether it's going to enforce its policy on the ACCC or whether it allows the ACCC to continue to be a rogue agency that makes its own policies and follows its own will. That's not the way things should work.
Graham Samuel, boss of the ACCC, argues the regulator is only doing its job.
What they're now doing is trying to have others act to try and take us out of the picture, to sideline us. Well, yeah, that's ultimately a matter for government. But you must understand that the ACCC never buckles under pressure of this sort of nature. What we do is we carry out our responsibilities under the law. Our responsibility is to look after 20 million Australians to ensure that they are not subject to monopoly prices by those that have got monopoly positions.
For those of you who have been marooned on a desert island, the ACCC and Telstra have been locked in a dispute over how much Telstra will charge to access its proposed network. Graham Samuel says it's up to Telstra to make its proposal public.
My challenge remains, Telstra, put it out into the open, put it out for public scrutiny. Let the world see what it is you're proposing.
The Communications Minister, Helen Coonan, is not impressed with Telstra's latest advertising blitz either.
Well, I think it's unhelpful. I think where we're up to, quite frankly, is that competing proposals need to have a public airing so that everyone has an opportunity to consider the merits of the proposals. There are merits in both, quite if you look at them. And we also need to have a look at the proposed prices.
The ACCC is expecting a detailed proposal from Telstra's Optus-led rival, the G9 Group, in the next few weeks. If Telstra doesn't get its way soon, Phil Burgess is threatening to take the telco's $4 billion bat and ball and go somewhere else.
We have many places we can invest $4.1 billion if the Australian people and elected leaders of the country, not the unelected bureaucrats at the ACCC, but if the elected leadership of the country and if the voters of the country decide they don't want broadband, then we have other places we can put the money and we'll do it.
And as for those ads that Telstra are choosing to run at the moment, here's Graham Samuel's response from the ACCC.
If I was to redraft or to draft a reply to the advertisements, they'd be very simple indeed. It would be to publish the same advertisement with the words, "What price?" in question mark, just scrawled right across it. What price is it that Australian consumers will pay for this grand plan?
This is a big world, and if for some reason the government decides that complacency and indifference about the future of telecommunications in Australia is better than building out broadband to everybody in this country, then that's a choice they have the power to make.
But the ruckus won't die down anytime soon. The pending federal poll scheduled for later this year will only heighten the situation as opposing telcos jostle and jockey into position to catch the broadband tsunami, which will no doubt be a result of a rash decision made by whichever party manages to survive the 2007 election. Dirty deeds done dirt cheap,
You betcha.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
All right, for you overseas listeners, we're nearly to the end of our self-indulgent telecommunications issue this week. I'd like to wrap up our little segment by just going to an article that appeared in the Business Day, which is off The Age, which is one of the newspapers here in Australia, in Melbourne in particular. There's an article in The Weekend that says, "Why We All Hate Telstra." to which Mark Pesky, please excuse me if I mispronounce that, came out and made a statement about the management of Telstra and how that once upon a time we had Australians running Telstra, but now we seem to have these Americans in there. He wrote this, and I quote from the article, it says, "But Telstra, arrogant and rapacious to its more or less American core, has got the gall to spruik itself as the saviour of Australian competitiveness. And they wonder why we hate them."
Yes, and as Graham Samuel said just a few moments ago on the show, at what price?
Exactly, exactly. Now, and that was a fairly interesting
It's not just
outburst.
The dollars that it's going to cost you your broadband per month. It's not just that price. It's the price of the, if we really stuff it up, it's going to be the price
the
of the
ongoing fix the, it up, long cost price.
Exactly, and the restrictions that are going to be placed on not being able to do things the same as the restrictions that are on the digital television at the moment. That really worry me.
All right, let's move on. When we return, we're going to talk to Mark Murray about this. What he came in to talk about, aviation, but we've been talking about all sorts of other things very much in sort Sounds of in the good. Short term.
We'll fly to it.
We'll fly to it, exactly. But in the meanwhile, it's time for Adam's view from the couch. And this week, Apple is in his view.
Oh, I want to hear this.
Adam Turner's view from the couch on Tech Talk Radio.
With all the hype about Apple's new Apple TV media player, people seem to overlook the fact that it doesn't actually do very much. Apple TV connects to your television and lets you play movies, music and photos stored on various computers around your house. They can be Macs or PCs, but they must be running iTunes. Frustratingly, this reliance on iTunes means you can't watch formats that won't play in iTunes, and you can't watch videos saved on a network storage device. Playing videos on your television sounds great, but in an act of high-tech snobbery, the Apple TV will only connect to fancy new televisions with high-definition component or HDMI inputs. Anything more than 2 or 3 years old is probably no good. The message from Apple is clear. If you don't have a fancy new television, you're not worthy of owning an Apple TV. If you can overcome this hurdle, the Apple TV lets you download video and television shows from the iTunes Store to watch on your television. This would be great, if only the Australian iTunes Store actually sold movies and television shows. Australians have to make do with music videos, short films, and video podcasts. Unfortunately, there's not a lot to get excited about if you're looking to be entertained rather than informed. You can actually get around this by shopping on the US iTunes Store using a US PayPal account linked to an Australian credit card, but Apple obviously frown upon this. If you've got video you've downloaded anywhere else on the internet, legitimately or otherwise, it requires a lengthy conversion process before it will play on the Apple TV. There's no built-in DVD player, nor can it play files from an external USB device. Despite the Apple TV's many shortcomings, Apple worshippers are raving about it, even though there are far more useful players available. Take a look at Z500series.com. The Zsonic Z500 player does everything the Apple TV does, but also has a DVD player that will do cool things like convert NTSC to PAL on the fly so you can watch DVDs bought from the US. It also plays a myriad of formats from practically any device you can throw at. The Z500 only costs about $100 more than the Apple TV. Now take a look at beyondwiz.com.au. That's BEYONWIZ. This month, BeyondWiz released the ultimate home entertainment device, the BeyondWiz DPS-1. Sure, it's 3 times the price of the Apple TV, but it offers at least 3 times the features. It's a dual-tuner, high-definition personal video recorder, a DivX DVD player, and a media player like the Apple TV. You'll soon be able to download movies to it from the internet as well, thanks to Ice TV's upcoming video-on-demand service. In short, entertainment nirvana. I've got one in my lounge room right now, and I'm planning to fake my own death and move to South America so I don't have to give it back. Like the Zsonic Z500, the BeyondWiz will play a myriad of file formats from any network-attached computer or storage device, as well as from CD, DVD, USB device, or memory card. No special formats, no special software. It's designed to do what people want to do rather than what vendors like Apple want them to do. Just as there are better MP3 players than the iPod, there are better media players than the Apple TV. Perhaps it's the right player for you, perhaps not. But don't buy into the Apple TV hype until you've stopped to consider what it can't do.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Listen up, it's Lydia here in Silicon Valley.
Tech Talk Radio's US correspondent, Lydia Davis, is offering listeners a chance to ask questions about blogging.
If you don't know the answer, I'll find out for you.
This is a great opportunity for people who are starting out in the world of blogging and why small businesses in particular would benefit from the Web 2.0 world. Visit Lydia's blog at blogwell.wordpress.com, or you can find the link on the Tech Talk Radio site. Go to the Tech Talk Radio tab on Blogwell and ask away. Fellow Aussies get preferential treatment. Take advantage of the fact that Lydia's also the marketing strategist for WebMama, one of Silicon Valley's biggest search engine optimization and search engine marketing firms. So why not hit her for some SEO help as well?
Come on, guys, let me have them.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back. A couple of our listeners have been sending us emails tonight. Hello, Darren in Manila, tech teacher at the International School of Manila. Great show, guys. Look forward to Skyping in soon. We'll be able to do that one day very shortly.
Hopefully, yeah.
It's one of those things on the to-do list and we've never quite got around to doing it, but it'll happen shortly. So, and Alan sent us an email saying... Shoutcast is not happening tonight. Yes, that is true. That's Dr. Ron's realm, and unfortunately Dr. Ron is indisposed this evening, and he did get the message. He had numerous SMSs saying, turn the Shoutcast on, but it was all too late, he cried. So apologies for those trying to hear us on Shoutcast tonight. A thought, though, from Alan. For OS X users, you might also point out that the Shoutcast stream being MP3 is also an iTunes stream. There you go.
Oh, yeah, that's how to listen to us on a Mac.
So on a Mac, go for the Shoutcast stream. So there you go. Hopefully it knows how to handle it. Well, you never know.
Very cool.
Right, aviation is a fairly interesting topic. Well, very big in demand on the Tech Talk Radio feedback poll. Let me tell you, one of the most, the biggest downloads, I think, Mark. That's a testament to how people like listening about aviation and things.
Isn't that nice?
It is. It is. There's been a lot happen of recent times. There's been the Qantas debacle, and the pilots have been out talking about just as well that didn't happen. And then we had the poor accident up in March, I think it was, up for Air Garuda
March
and stuff like that.
March 7th in Indonesia, yeah.
Where should we start?
We'll start at Qantas first, eh?
Yeah, let's start at home.
So, well, yeah, what's the pilot's perspective on the Qantas business?
So just for those who aren't in our country and don't know what we're talking about, a private equity firm came in and tried to buy Qantas from underneath us.
Yep.
And it was fairly hot news for a good couple of months even.
It was. Well, last time I was here, November 23, I got newspaper headlines here. Qantas flies sky high on buyout plan and Qantas mulls over $10 billion bid. And that was in November last year.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as Andrew was just saying, Airline Partners Australia, made up of Macquarie Bank and a Texas Pacific group, tried to buy us.
Yeah, and private equity people try and come in and strip assets and turn it around, chew it up, spit it out, and there you go. So it was a bit of a worry, really.
Well, it was interesting. I'm actually a Qantas shareholder. I have 2,500 shares in Qantas.
Right. Oh, so you've been riding the roller coaster.
Well, I've been riding the roller coaster. It's been so interesting because I was given them as part of benefits as an employee.
And as part of the salary package.
Salary package. And they terminated. I didn't have them accumulated anymore, but they've just been sitting there ticking away over a period of time.
Yep.
And I got this first letter saying, with this big, thick document, as thick as a Bible, and it was almost as big on all the rules and regulations of this new buyout. Buy now. You know, sell now. They want to buy now, sell. And a value of what your shares would be if you sign the dotted line now, you'd get X $1,000 right now, sign now.
Yep.
And then I got another one, and then have to do it.
There's more.
And you have to do it by whatever it was, March 7th, and then it was March 20th, and then it was I counted, I think, 8 or 9 extensions we had.
Mm.
And each time was getting more and more desperate with bigger and bigger font each time on the front of the of the cell now, and prepaid envelopes and things where all I had to do was put the tiniest little cross and they would all be done for me. And they'd send me a check. But according to Terry McCran and a lot of other people in the financial industries, we're getting a raw deal. And it really was a raw deal. 5:40 and it's 5:27.
I wonder if their timing was bad. Like, I'm no financial guru, but I do watch the stock market from time to time. And I suspect that, well, you hear it every day. Oh, the stock market's closed at another record high. Again. Maybe their timing was bad.
I think their timing was bad. And I also think they underestimated the Australian public. And I think they underestimated who actually had the shares. See, Qantas shares, unlike if you had BHP, MIM, or Telstra shares, you can't really see it, but people can proudly see an aeroplane fly over and they can sit in one and say, I own part of this company. And it has that Qantas, Queensland and Northern Territory aerial service. It does have a lot more, you know, emotion than a lot of other shares do.
As well as the overseas sort of pride value of seeing the flying kangaroo in the foreign airports and so on.
Absolutely.
And having the really enviable safety record.
That is so true.
And so if these guys got in, what would have happened? Like, from a pilot's point of view, what was the biggest fear towards... Would it be...
Carving up, I guess, is the biggest fear.
Yeah.
Not knowing what they want to do with this. Because, see, Qantas already has a couple of feelers in cheap airlines. And those cheaper airlines pay a lot less and they have different standards, et cetera, et cetera. And pilots always worry about the future of, are we going to be sold out underneath? Are we going to be made redundant? Are they going to cut costs?
Is Qantas going to become Jetstar?
Well,
the cutting of costs would have been a serious issue from safety.
Yes, absolutely.
Right down the line through everything.
There is a worldwide shortage of pilots, and pilots actually at this current stage have the upper hand, as that the other airlines overseas are making great generous offers for pilots to come and join us.
Right.
Emirates, Gulf Air, Pan Pacific or whatever. There's quite a few.
And Qantas is seen as a good place to work as a pilot?
Yes, it is. It's seen as a great place to work. However, if someone else is offering you 3 times the amount with a tax-free haven and all these other benefits, and you think, well, I could work 25 years or I could work 5 years overseas and then retire, it becomes a very lucrative thing.
You went into retirement just way too soon, huh?
Yeah.
unfortunately, but nonetheless.
Put on me by the gods. But summing it up anyhow, Andrew, it was. I think they really did underestimate the public. I think they underestimated the people who held the shares, which were mums and dads and lots of people who work for Qantas. So the actual people who worked there had the shares, and I don't think any of them wanted to sell.
I think there was a vicious rumour around during the course of the week, which the private equity guys were now switching their attention from Qantas to Telstra. Bring it on, I reckon.
Yes, and Macquarie aren't shy. They're very, let's say...
not.
Yeah, I'm using my words carefully because I don't want to be sued by them, but aggressive, I would say, the word.
I think they'd like to hear that, wouldn't they?
Yes, and so it's quite nice that they fell flat on their face, and also the Qantas board. I mean...
Well, there's going to be a change in the board now, isn't there?
Well, the Qantas board supported the sale, didn't they?
100%. And this is the thing that we didn't like as well. Well, she's gone. But when I got a letter saying that 9 out of 9 of the board members said, you must buy this, it's fantastic, straight away, and this is like the rest of the pilots, our ears prick with suspicion. What's going on?
Yeah.
Why are you telling me this? You're telling me there's something you mustn't be telling me. If you're all telling me yes, I'm going to have to say no and then look further and find out myself.
All right.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm just going to, because Dr. Ron's not here tonight, we might play a little excerpt from him. But I want to talk about technology in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
We take for granted in this country things like mobile phones and safe aircraft and the likes. And
moderately speed broadband.
Exactly.
Moderately priced.
So what I'm going to do, I'll play this bit from Dr. Ron, who had a chat with one of his colleagues, friends, I guess, from Pakistan.
Okay.
An Australian, an expat working in Pakistan. So he through the bottom of a glass, he did this great interview.
Okay.
And when we come back, Mark, I'm going to ask you about some of the experiences you might have had with technology and flying in other countries, and do we take it all for granted in this country?
If there's one thing that never ceases to amaze us at Tech Talk Radio, it's the fascinating people, just like you, that listen to our humble podcast from far-flung corners of the globe. Andy is an Australian expat who lives in Islamabad, the capital city of Pakistan. And in addition to podcasting the National 9 News every day, He also listens to Tech Talk Radio on his iPod. Now, we take fast internet access for granted in first world countries, but I was curious to know what types of services are available in Islamabad and how you connect to the internet. I had the opportunity to catch up with Andy while he was in Melbourne last week. So, at great expense to the management, we headed for the Sherlock Holmes in Collins Street, and over a few quiet ales, I asked Andy about life and technology in a war-torn country like Pakistan.
It's a bit of a lottery sometimes with the internet, but particularly in the monsoon season where it can drop in and out quite rapidly. But by and large, the broadband service is pretty good.
Tell me about broadband in Pakistan. Is it ADSL? Is it satellite? Is it wireless? How do you access the internet?
It's DSL, and I've only actually in the house just set up a wireless system, so I have the luxury of being able to use the laptop anywhere in the house. And as I say, by and large, it's a pretty good service for a country that doesn't necessarily have the standard of services that we have back here in Oz.
What speeds do you access the internet at?
Normally around the sort of the 50s, but it can vary down to the 20s. I suppose, as with any service that's not 100%.
Is that kilobits per second, like 50 kilobits per second or more?
Absolutely, yeah, KBS.
What about other options that are available to you? Have you explored satellite or any of those sorts of options, or are they just not an option at all?
Look, I haven't. I've just taken the off-the-shelf DSL and spend my energy exploring other technological fun times.
Tell me about other types of technology in Pakistan. Mobile phones. Tell me a little bit about mobile phone technology.
Look, again, the mobile network is dominated by a couple of major players, and once again, like any of the countries in this region, is not always dependable, but generally a good service. Texts are obviously very, very cheap by Australian standards, the service is considerably cheaper, but not necessarily always the standard of an Aussie service.
Who are the carriers over there at the moment?
Mobile Link are probably the major carrier, but there are a couple of other carriers as well. I'm personally with Mobile Link.
What sort of costs are you looking at on a monthly basis for your mobile phone plans?
Oh, look, to give a good indication, my internet service, which is an unlimited internet service on the PDA, costs around the equivalent of $10 a month Aussie.
All right, and that's unlimited. What about internet access? What are you paying for internet at the moment over there?
Yeah, the internet is the equivalent of about $20 a month for the DSL.
And is that unlimited?
It's not, but it's a fairly generous limit.
All right, do you have any issues in Pakistan with firewalls or the government regulating content like they do in other countries?
Not that I've come across yet, not that I've explored everything on the internet from Pakistan, but I've certainly noticed bigger differences in the UAE to what we get in Pakistan in terms of firewalls and government limit.
So you don't find yourself having content blocked by the government?
No, not at all. I think unless you're running specific blog sites that might be so pointed that they attract that attention, then there's probably not much worry at all.
Andy, tell us about the weather station which you run at home at the moment.
Yeah, just as a side interest, I've got a remote weather station on the roof that pretty much beams all the data back to a standalone PC downstairs and then interfaces with the LCD TV, so at any one time you can get a good picture of the weather. I didn't actually have that in October 2005 when the South Asian earthquake came through, which in itself was a very different experience. Basically about 10 to 9 on a Saturday morning, the house just began to shake, and it was literally like a freight train running down the street. The only trouble is there's no train lines within, 20 or 30 kilometres of where I live. And it was quite frightening. It put a number of cracks, like 30 or 40 cracks in the house, and honestly believed the house was going to fall down.
Tell us about a new hobby which you've recently become involved with, model aircraft.
Yeah, Dr. Ron, I'm not sure where this fascination with airwaves has come from, but it obviously goes back a number of decades. And the latest fascination is remote control helicopters. And they say RTF, which is ready to fly. That's what it says on the box. And I can tell you right now,
I thought RTF was read the manual or something.
No, ready to fly. And it should be, it really should be ARTF, which is almost ready to fly. The fact that they're now battery controlled at this entry level as opposed to gas or fuel is just fantastic, and that's the latest hobby.
What do the locals think when they see a battery-powered helicopter fly past them on the street?
Look, I'm yet to find out, but I can gather that the reaction is going to be similar to the numerous aerials that come off my house anyway. And I just hope the two don't clash, actually, that the weather station doesn't somehow take control of the chopper.
What sort of antennas do you have hanging off the house at the moment? Are they for business use or for personal use?
No, basically for personal use. And I mean, each of the weather stations got its own little transmitter, so, and its own solar-powered transmitter that transmits to the base station. So, yeah, plenty of radio waves bouncing around off my current residence. It was actually all Australian purchased and sent over to me in pieces, which probably looked quite interesting coming through the mail system, but ultimately the whole lot was put together and it's up and running. It took about 6 months to get the thing working in terms of getting it over and getting it installed and finally tuned.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Do you have a hobby like that, Mark, into remote control helicopters or anything?
My good buddy Marco Di Varelli does, no, but I'd never actually been able to fly one of
They're
those.
They're pretty lethal when the radio frequencies get jammed. You can't control them and they go out of control.
I've been to a few air shows where they do demos of them, yeah, and it's pretty, pretty very talented. No, I've never flown a modern aeroplane.
But speaking of real aeroplanes, have you ever flown into some locations where technology hasn't quite worked for you?
Well, pre-September 11, yes, technology and interesting things were more frequent than they are now. I think the world has woken up a lot and even the outer skirts place, but for example, I was where technology was interesting once, or lack of there, in Santorini in the Greek islands.
Yes.
We go out to the airport to fly from Santorini back to Athens.
Yeah.
And firstly, animals are allowed anywhere. They're wandering through. There's a cat in the corner licking itself, a dog barking, people talking. We go through the security. Security's there. There's this big black and white screen there, and there's a sort of a loopy thing that you go through. And over in the corner, the guys are playing cards and smoking.
Okay.
And I'm looking, this is technology that was probably made during when, I don't know, chaos and that were in control. And it was really, really old technology, plus no one was even using it. That was really, really interesting. That was quite funny to me. And also, the opposite end in Athens in that same trip when we got there, instead of using the technology where they could actually search bags, they didn't switch to this is in Athens, they didn't actually switch on the technology. They had guys in T-shirts and jeans just really casual riffling through everyone's bags looking for stuff.
Oh, good.
So they didn't actually use x-ray machines and they were using just hands-on, which Sandra took a exception to and just grabbed a bag and walked away and they didn't try to stop her. So
my only recollection of Athens was, I think we stopped over there one day when we were flying through to Europe.
Yeah.
And they just open the doors up and they leave, you know, you're all sitting on the aircraft while they change the galley and do all that sort of stuff. They don't seem to care about anything and you sit there for an hour in the aircraft.
Very relaxed, yeah.
So like, oof. And yeah, you just notice it when the air is thick.
Wouldn't do these days, would it?
No,
definitely wouldn't do these days. Look, I'm not having any dispersions on anything about it, just as that was my experience at the time. But it is interesting. But talking about a little bit of, sorry about you saying about technology. Technology still doesn't help when human error comes into force. And unfortunately, we're talking about disasters before. And a good resource for disaster follow-ups, if you are looking for, is airdisaster.com, which has a database of flights and crashes and things. And we're talking about the one that happened in March earlier this year in Indonesia, where Air Garuda went in.
Yeah, yeah, we'll talk about that. We'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll have a chat about Air Garuda, because what happened there, it was a whole heap of errors in a lot of respect, really, but the whole upshot was he came in too fast. Is that right?
And I'll have a talk about what that means. Yeah.
All right, we'll be back with that after this.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, On a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
visiting the relatives, washing the car. Pressing.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
Feedback at techtalkradio.com.au is our email address. You can email us now while we're on air. If we're not on air, you can email us anyway. We'll respond. We're those sort of type of guys, really. We get lots of emails from time to time. So
it's always good to get emails.
I love getting emails, especially from people who have good things and bad things to say about the program. Too much of this, too much of that. Charlie pressing issues, all that sort of stuff. It's great to get those sort of emails. I must check them emails at the moment. So, yes. Mark Mayer joins us this evening, retired Qantas pilot. We're talking about aviation and technology therein and the results of certain things that have been untoward of recent times, including Air Garuda. You don't speak that highly of Air Garuda, Mark. So.
Well, without any legal ramifications, no, I'm not overly impressed with their record. They're
based on track record, not good.
Track record in the last, since 1950, they've had 18 crashes on the database. Ooh. I could find. And I know this sounds really dreadful, but 1987, they had a major crash, lost 27 passengers. 93, they had a crash. They didn't hurt anyone, that one. 96, they lost three. And 1997, in Indonesia, they crashed and killed 234. Lost another passenger in 2002. And in March, well, when we're talking about now, March 2007, the aircraft was on a scheduled passenger flight from Jakarta, and it overran the runway, caught fire, and was destroyed while landing at Yogyakarta Airport.
So when you overrun a runway, mm-hmm. that means probably one of two things, I guess. One is the weather wasn't quite in your favour, or B, there was something more sinister at play, either an equipment failure or human error, I guess. Is that
or a combination of all.
Yep. So did the brakes not work? Or
well, okay, this is my report will be based on my conjecture, based on what I've
read. So it's your opinion, because we haven't had findings yet.
There's
at this
no
stage.
Official findings yet. There'll be a lot of legal ramifications for that. However, it looks like the initial investigation has found that the aircraft was too fast on approach. Now, initially, everyone in the passengers was saying to the media, oh, it was coming in too fast, it was coming in too fast.
Yeah, I remember those.
Which really piqued my curiosity, because I was really curious how passengers in the back part of the aeroplane ascertain the approach speed of an arriving aircraft. Do they know that it approaches 140 knots or 155 knots or 200 knots? Or, I mean, that.
I don't know. Perhaps I've landed in America, and I can tell you that the difference in landing in Australia and America is completely different.
Yeah. But see, there's so many things that a passenger aren't. I mean, I can look out the window when I'm in the back, and I can see if we're high or low, because I know the things to look for. But I would not be able to tell. I could tell if it was really, really fast, yes. But there's also illusions of you may have a great tailwind and you maybe look like you're going fast and you're going, but your actual airspeed is still the same as it is. So if you look out the window, you may look like you're going fast. So all I'm getting to say, I guess I'm saying is that the media did jump on this too fast, without a lot of backing first. And I'm not really fond of the media making a lot of assumptions about things when there are quite technical things. By saying too fast is a very, very broad thing, and it doesn't really mean a lot until you actually put it in a perspective. It's like saying,
so what will they get from the flight box recorder?
Well, what they'll get from that, they'll get two things. They'll get the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. Flight data recorder records absolutely everything that goes on the airplane.
Australian invention too, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. It is. It's an Australian invention. And another piece of trivia, the black box is orange.
Yes, I've often seen them pull them out of wreckages and go, hey, that's not very black to me.
The black box
but
is
it
orange.
Records what all the instruments were saying and where all the levers were and all that sort of cool stuff.
Is it like data or is it?
It's data. Yeah, it's called the air data. Well, the air data computer.
Wouldn't be a hard drive. What sort of technology would be in it?
It's actually very hot, very, very interesting technology. It's recorded on a metal tape.
Metal tape.
Metal tape that can take, I don't know the exact, and I can find out for next time if you want more detail on that, but it can take a lot of temperature and they can be almost destroyed. Yep. But it's recorded on a metal tape, and that tape then is analysed, and then you get all the details, and that's where the levers were, where they'll move, and how much they'll move by, what temperatures in the engines, what temperatures in the front of the engine, the back of the engine, where the ailerons were, where the gear was, all those
and
things.
And the airspeed indicator.
And the airspeed indicator, correct.
So they can recreate what happened moments before the incident occurred.
Exactly. And then they can match that with the voice and then put it all together to get a very, very detailed picture.
So you can hear whether the pilots were worried about the airspeed being too high or whatever. Or whatever, the brake's not working, or the wheel's not working properly.
Exactly. What does this red light mean?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Whatever you do, don't push that button.
Yeah.
But with all those things taken into consideration, it does look like it was pilot error.
Okay.
Now, when you're coming in to land at an airport, you have a certain parameters where you have to set certain key points. Mm-hmm. Passing a certain point, you have to be at a certain height, a certain speed, another key point, a certain height, certain speed,
yep.
with certain configurations. If you're in those so-called gates, your landing gear is down, your flap selection is in the right section, and you're in a band of airspeed of plus or minus, you know, a couple of knots, one or two knots, then you continue with the approach. And when you do that, you'll be coming exactly on a 3-degree glide slope, and you'll be landing at the 1,000-foot marker on the runway, which is what we plan for.
Or on the studio bench here,
or the studio bench, is there, for emphasis. I'm using my hands, folks, to just make these little aeroplane movements. You can always, that's another saying, you always be able to tell pilots talking at a party from a distance because they make all these hand movements, yeah. and I was doing this, and I was doing that.
Is there a point of no return in a landing?
Yes, there is, yeah.
What point is that? Just marginally before the wheels are on the ground?
No, it's actually, it has moved since I left. We had different positions, but I think it's a 1,000 feet now. I could be corrected, and other pilots are going to ring and say, no, it's all changed. But there's a final point where you say, yes, I'm established. And it means that you are now in the landing configuration. It means you've got the gear down, you have the landing flap selected, and you have the landing speed under control, mm-hmm. which means I'm now in control and I know I'm going to land. If you haven't have the aircraft configured by this point, and this point where let's just make up this point. Let's say it's at 500 feet, okay? Mm.
For this 500 argument, feet before it hits the...
500 feet above the ground.
500 feet up, 500
feet AGL, above yep. ground level. It may have changed, and I think Qantas have changed a couple of their standards to make it even more safer. So mm-hmm. I may be correct, but we'll make it for our argument, call it 500 feet.
Yeah.
So at 500 feet, we'll have our gear down, we'll have our landing gear in, our flat landing flaps and the flap selection of 30 degrees, and we'll have the approach speed, which varies according to the weight of the aircraft, the height of the airplane, height of the elevation.
A lot of factors
involved. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So to say fast, but let's say it's 140 knots today. So we're on 140 knots, plus or minus a knot. So we're not going to be plus or minus. And if we're in that slot at that position, then we continue to land. If we're not in that position, then that's what you said. This is our point of no return. We say, okay, we're going to go around.
Bag it up and off you go again.
We're out of here.
What sort of technology is involved in landing an aircraft from an automated point of view? Are you in full manual by this stage, or are you relying on some form of computer technology to get you to that last 500 feet?
The answer is yes to both. You can either be fully manual or you can be fully automated. And all of Qantas aircraft, we're going to do both. Mm-hmm. We manually land them a number of times like that to keep our hands in, but you can also be fully automated and the aircraft can actually land it. To go around is actually a very interesting thing. This is actually more exciting. When it lands, the throttle slowly come back, the nose slowly pitches up and it lands, which is a fairly simple procedure. But going around is a little bit more complex because going around, you have to pitch the aircraft up, you have to raise the flaps, you have to raise the gear, bring the thrusts up, and it's actually very interesting watching the airplane do that by itself. And when you go around, you say going around, you hit the takeoff go around button, the throttles come up by themselves, you select gear up, you start accelerating away, and as you come up, as the speed starts building, you select the flaps up, and it's pitching up to 15.5 degrees, I think it is, and it's flying away by itself.
And at this stage, the pilot's got his feet up on the console and drinking a cup of coffee, has he?
Not exactly, but he could if he really, really, really wanted to. He could, because it's that hands-off. It'll still hold the runway heading for you,
yep.
mm-hmm. and if you've got any special procedures, aircraft procedures, that could be programmed in, so it may turn at the end of the runway onto a certain heading and then continue to climb, and then you just report going around and blah, blah, blah. So what I'm building up here is a picture that a pilot should know very, very clearly where he is and what he's going to be doing. Now, if you start getting behind the aircraft, which means you're starting getting labored with more things happening, you've left your descent checklist too late, you've left the gears too late, and that might not have been your fault. You may have been held up by air traffic, you may have had a problem passenger, the flight attendant may have come up, certain things happen. If you're starting to get loaded up and you're getting behind the aircraft and you get to this position where you think, no, I can't do it anymore, then you go around. And there's no shame in that. Every pilot's done that. I've done that numerous times. Every pilot does
it. It's a good option.
It's a very good option.
If in doubt, go around.
No shame. Yep. If you don't do that and you continue to go, you're getting yourself in a very, very dangerous position.
So what happens if you miss the piano keys? You've got to land on them, don't you?
We aim for the piano keys. Yeah. And if you do...
They're the black and white stripy bits on the end of a runway.
The big ones. Well, there's earlier ones, but there's a 1,000-foot marker, which are the big, big white ones, which means that you'll clear all obstacles approaching the runway by a 3-degree gradient.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're coming in on. And you aim for the 1,000-foot marker. And so when you hit the 1,000-foot marker, you'll be plus or minus, very, very close. You watch, most jets will all land between there. And if you're a little bit long and you float maybe a little bit because you had just maybe a couple of knots extra speed and you maybe just flared out your nose rotation just a tiny bit more, you maybe go a bit further. But see, that's all nicely built into your factor. So there's that fudge factor in there. And as soon as you land, the brakes hit on, the reverse thrusters come in and pull you up. But when you've got excess energy and you've come in much too fast and too high, you're going to be diving into them much deeper into the runway anyhow. And you'll be beyond a part where it is impossible, physically impossible, for that aircraft to pull up. There's only one thing to do. If you've hit that, if you've gone in there, there's only one thing to immediately hit full thrust and go around.
And that's what this pilot didn't do, you suspect?
I suspect on all the information that I've got through my sources, that they were high on approach and they were fast. And they continued
that would have been most likely because...
Well, I can't...
Any number of reasons.
Any number of reasons.
Purely speculative from here on in, isn't
but
it?
But yes, so it's speculative of how and why that reason came up. But
and it'll come out in
it does look like
appropriate
and
then
he's just they continued
in that,
with
that
situation.
Fraction of a second he had to make the decision to stay or to go when he's chosen to stay when he should have gone.
Yeah, well, he would. You see it coming up to you. This is the problem. So you see it coming up to you. You think, gee, we're getting behind. Come on, we've got the checklist to go. We haven't got the gear down yet. We've got the flap down. Quick, get it all down. If you think that's happening, then you say, look, this is not looking good. But I have heard rumors, and this is unconfirmed, that... it costs money to do this too. To go around means you have to maybe slot into another aeroplane. You may be delayed. It's going to delay other flights, delay other passengers.
You use a lot more
cost
fuel,
et cetera, et cetera.
A slot being your allocated
slot
time to land.
Time. And I heard that they had bonuses and negative bonuses for pilots who went around. Now, this is what you can get with cut-cutting airlines. And this is the problem, you see. If you get a bonus of saying if you go around, you're going to lose money for it, it's going to come into your back pocket. And now it's going to come into your decision, which I think is the worst thing that an airline could ever do, to make it cost you money to make it a command decision.
Now, that's a very good point. Mm. But one other thing is I've read some of the information that's out there on the internet. There's a couple of interesting websites with investigations on these crashes.
Yes.
And I've never read one where it came down to one single factor.
Yeah, that's
it's
correct.
I've never read a single one where it's just been pilot error or it's just been, you know, a mechanical failure. There's always three or four or five or 28 different things that have contributed.
Yep, that's correct, Graham. We call it the chain of events. And what we try to do is break that chain, that cycle. And that's why that that go-no-go pipe that I said, that theoretical 500 feet, that's where we break that chain. So we may have got so busy, forgotten, got really worried, there was bad weather, but we got to 500 feet and we both looked down and we thought, we haven't got the gear, we haven't got this, we're going round. And that's what try to break that chain of events, and you're right, Graham.
When you say a large aircraft comes in at 140 knots, does that apply to a light aircraft too? Is it speed relative?
Speed relative to the weight of the aircraft usually and the size of the aircraft. So
a lighter aircraft comes in a lot slower.
Lot slower, yeah. So say a little two-seater trainer airplane would have an approach speed of, say, 50 to 60 knots.
Yeah.
And a jet aircraft, say from a 737 to a 767, could have something a bit 140 to 160. Mm-hmm. And a 747 a bit heavier may have actually the newer ones, they come in fairly about the same. So 150 to 160.
Can I ask a really dumb sort of layman's question?
Oh, there's no dumb questions.
Like
only dumb people.
No. How fast is a knot?
Okay.
Good question, Graham.
One knot is an aeronautical, it comes from the ocean, actually.
It does. Yeah. And I know how they did this.
Go ahead.
I saw a documentary on this the other day, and what they used to do is they used to tie knots into a rope, and they would throw it out at sea, and then the knots would be the number of knots that would pass at a predetermined spacing in this rope, and that they could say, we're doing five knots, because in a minute we let out five knots.
Okay.
But I don't know how it equates to...
For those of us
history.
Who think in kilometres per hour or miles per hour...
Okay, in kilometres per hour, it varies with temperature and pressure to what it is, but I think 140 knots is probably about 200 kilometres now.
Okay.
Not quite. Not quite double.
Yeah, not quite double. Yeah. Not quite double. I've got a computer it's called a computer, but a handheld slide rule that we use in the airplane, and I can give you those exact figures. Next time I'll bring that in for you, and I'll give you some figures.
Yeah, but that gives us a rough idea anyway, what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
it's pretty fast. Yeah.
Let's talk about cabin baggage. That's all changed in international laws and things like that too. What's going on here? You can't take... Everything has to be in plastic bags now these days.
Yeah, well, from the 31st of March 2007, Department of Transport and Regional Services has changed the rules about what you can take on an airplane as hand luggage.
Now, this is international opposed to domestic.
Yeah, international. So far, domestic is unchanged. But international, you're only allowed 100 milliliters per container of liquid substances, meaning drinks, creams, perfumes, sprays,
anything.
Gels, toothpaste. Yes. So if you've got any liquid, you can only take 100 mils of that particular liquid, and it has to be in... taken in small containers. And these will be admitted to, through the screening point on international parades as carry-on baggage. And these items must be placed in a reusable, clear plastic bag.
It's like when you get your laptop out and whack it on the tray separately these days when you go through. Yeah.
So you get a big plastic freezer bag that's see-through.
And should you do this at home before you leave? Like I recommend that.
And the exceptions for these rules are obviously medical people with medical conditions, people with baby food to be consumed on board. However, they still have to go through the security checks. You can take normal things on, and after you go through screening, if there's duty free or something after you've gone through, you can then also purchase that, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm. So why are they concerned about liquids? Why are they concerned about things in bottles?
Well, because you can carry a lot of contraband in bottles that no one can tell. For example, and I'm not advocating this, but you could take a lot of, for example, everyone in technology, so I'm not being silly, you know, hand washing stuff, you know, the alcohol hand washing stuff?
Yeah. Yep.
That is highly flammable, as you probably all know. Well, you could fill up 10 tubes of that in a toothpaste gel and take it on. Now you've got a heap of flammable stuff on board an airplane, haven't you?
I see.
You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, which probably would be a bad thing.
It would be a bad thing, yeah. So what they're trying to do is they want you to be able to see what sort of liquids you have on board.
Yep.
And is it purely liquids that they're targeting with these new measures?
At this stage, it's according to my sources here, it's, yes, liquids.
Because they already had rules about sharp things.
Sharp things and all those sorts of things and all that sort of stuff.
I recall we
radioactive and all the other dangerous goods.
We travel with camera equipment quite a bit and they get very upset about screwdrivers these days too.
Yeah, screwdrivers.
They all have to be checked and things like that. So little things that you would think would be harmless for doing like jewelers' screwdrivers.
Anything sharp they could use. No, you can't use it anymore. But yes.
All right. So you're listening to Tech Talk Radio. Mark Mayer joins us this evening. He used to fly these big things around the sky for a crust, and now he comes in and talks to us about it. We'll take a break in just a sec. We're going to join Lydia Davis from Palo Alto. But just before we do that, Mark, the safest air in the world, is it Australia in respect to congestion, I guess?
Look, thank you for a segue. My biased opinion is yes. Reasons being, first, we have a very big country, wide open spaces with not a lot of bad weather. We don't have huge rocky mountains.
Nothing much to hit, really, is there?
Well, there's nothing over 8,000 feet, so therefore the big cumuliforms and all the big tornadoes, we don't have rocky mountains, we don't have an Alps, we don't have Russian Alps, we don't have anything like that. We have lots of big wide open spaces, not a lot of water in the air, mostly desert, not a lot of congestion. So
good weather, too.
Good weather. And, you know, if we do have bad weather, we know where it's going to be. It's very easy to see most of the time. In the tropics in Cairns or Darwin, you know when it's going to come in a short period of time and it's gone.
What about congestion? Like, you know, as a motorist, when you drive up a major highway, you know that there's cars on the other side of the road coming towards you. Does aviation work that same way?
Very similar. The hubs in Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane and Australia are biggest, obviously. And our congestion there, I think we have aircraft movement. I don't know the exact figures, but I think there's like one every minute out of Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
But in bigger places like that, you'll see the photographs of half a dozen jets going as soon as they can go. Yeah. Wake turbulence is tight as possible. So our congestion is very, very low comparatively.
Mm. All right. And compared to what would be the most busiest airspace? Would it be the United States or in Europe
somewhere? I think so. I think it was a New York airport. It might be one of those.
Well, they've got
busiest.
Three airports there,
I think
JFK
it is. JFK and LaGuardia. I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Mm.
Or Heathrow as well, of course.
Oh, Heathrow.
Being a big hub through Europe.
Yes. They run out of place to park the planes at Heathrow. Yeah, I've spent an hour there waiting for them to clear up a terminal. Just anyway, we're going to take a little break. Lydia Davis joins us regularly from Palo Alto in the United States, and she's got a bit of a deal going at the moment. If you're interested in SEO, search engine optimization, search engine marketing, she works for one of the biggest companies or a large company in Silicon Valley called WebMummer, and they do search engine optimization things. And she's saying come along to her blog, which is Blogwell at wordpress.com, and you can ask her questions about blogging. If you're new to blogging, if you want a blog, if you don't even know what a blog is, log on to her site and have a bit of a chat. And if she doesn't know the answer, she told me the other day that she will personally go and find out and send you an email in response. So there you go. If you're interested in blogging, have a check out Lyd's blog site. But in the meanwhile, we had a chat. I had a chat to Lyd last week about Web 2.0. We spoke about that on our show recently, the new collaborative web websites and things like that are all starting to kick in. But how big is it in the United States?
We're talking to Lydia Davis today from Palo Alto in California about Web 2.0, something which is starting to surface over here, as we spoke about last week on Tech Talk Radio. But tell us about Web 2 in the United States. It's going gangbusters, is it, Lyd?
It is going gangbusters. It's interesting because here it's very commonly thrown about, the term, to the point where I'm almost, I hate saying it. I really don't like saying it. I'll find every other name, collaborative web, semantic web, whatever it is. I'll try and find whatever it is I can use so I don't have to say the dreaded Web 2.0. But, I look at it and I just can't believe, what it is, because way back when, and you had the board, and we'd get there, and we'd have a chat, and we'd be able to, share software. And
oh, that was back in the Maximus software days. I think that was before the internet even came in, where people rang into a computer.
It was before the web came in. It was before Mr. Berners-Lee gave us the web. So we had, I was using Telex, I remember this, and, the one in the RAM.
Blast from the past.
Yeah, so do you remember that time? And I remember, without a doubt, people, my friends saying to me, you're so antisocial. You're always on that computer, rah, 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 rah. And I'm thinking, it's funny because now it's gone full circle and we're really having the same, Web 2 is really the same thing. It's just about communicating and collaborating and sharing stuff with
being
others.
Being antisocial.
Basically, yeah. And it really strikes me as odd because, we had that a long time ago. We just didn't have the pretty pictures and the videos. I mean,
well, that's it, isn't it? It's the pretty pictures. It's the pretty pictures and the interface now, which is making it go full circle, isn't it?
It is. Now what's happening is it's becoming really easy to use all these products that are out there available for everyone to use, and most of them are free. The majority of Web 2 stuff generally is free because it's all open source. People want to share their stuff, and that's supposedly the future of the internet, where this is what the term Web 2 actually was coined by a guy called Tim O'Reilly here, and that was, I think, in 2003 or something. So it was a while ago, but he was saying, this is what it is. You basically need to share stuff with others, and that's the true definition of Web 2, sharing, the collaboration, and the more you share, obviously, the more interested.
So give us some examples of some Web 2 sites that come to mind.
I actually have, you're going to hate me for this, because you sent me an email last night saying, hey, I need to get this stuff about Marissa Mayer that she was talking about with Universal Search, and I sent you the link to their press page.
And I thought it was one of the most poorly updated web press pages that I've seen anywhere.
Well, they do the best they can. I mean, what's
so old? It's months old. It's April. Like, goodness me.
No, going back to, you asked me about Universal Search and the press stuff, and I sent you the link. Now, what I didn't do was say, hey, use Web 2.0. If you go to YouTube and search for Universal Search, Google Universal Search, or Marissa Mayer, who because you've read the press release, obviously, because I saw you had written something, so you knew a little bit about it. If you have a little bit of information, you go to a Web 2.0 site or a collaborative site like YouTube, where you have video and audio, and there are dozens of them. You go there, type it in, it offers a search for you, and it comes back and speaks back a 3-minute video of Marissa Mayer talking about exactly what you asked me about. Not on a Google website, no, but someone out there somewhere has recorded her and put it up onto YouTube. So, this is the beauty of, I suppose, live web, semantic web, collaborative web. The beauty of user, so that's the term, user-generated content. People, being able to suddenly stop being just users of computers, but rather producers of, of stuff on the internet.
Of content,
so they can,
yes,
start being editing. Sorry?
Of content, producers of content.
Absolutely, yeah. So they, there's videos, there's podcasts, there's text, there's everything out there. You just have to know where to look for it, and that's the thing. So you probably know YouTube. I know you know YouTube, but not everyone in Australia knows YouTube, because I was talking to a few people in Australia and they went, "You what?"
Well,
and
they must have their head in the sand, because YouTube is in mainstream media every day for the wrong reasons.
Let's talk about Flickr with photos. There's a Web 2 product, 4 million members. Put photos up, get photos from there. These are people who are taking photos. These are just, you know, citizens of the world taking photos of whatever interests them and putting them up onto Flickr. So suddenly you have access to so many millions of photos. Fotki, which is F-O-T-K-I, another one. Picasa Web, you know about. Smug Mug, Ringo, Photo Bucket, which I think you spoke about not long ago, 41 million members or something like that.
Yeah, it was our website of the week last week.
Yeah. Zuma, Kyle TV. You know, Kyle TV is very similar to, I suppose, YouTube. Met Cafe, Video Sift, Blink, Broadcaster.com. You know, 26 million people, you know, are there putting stuff up. Bolt, Podshow, AOL, Video, iFilm, Webshots, Odeo.
And these are all Web 2 allegedly functional websites.
They are. You know, I suppose they're called networking sites where you go and you chat to people that have the same interests and you share stuff with people that have the same interests. So, you know, using tags, categorizing your information well is now allowing others to search for it and find exactly what they're looking for. So, you know, tonight when you need a grab of Marissa Mayer, go to YouTube instead of going to Google because you'll find it all on Web 2.0. Sorry, I had to say Web 2.0. I had to say that.
So when do we see Web 3.0?
I don't know. I think the idea, you know, is everyone's talking about the semantic web, you know, or the meaningful web. We need a meaningful search product. We need a meaningful this. You know, something that is useful to users. And, you know, I really believe that because I remember, like I said to you, I remember the, you know, the days of Archie and they, you know, the guy that developed Archie saying, hey, yeah, brain damage. You know, this product is brain damaged. And I'm thinking, you know, Google's still brain damaged. All the search products are still brain damaged, but they're getting better. And you like that?
It is. It's a good way of putting it, actually. Well, just to conclude, with Web 2.0, are we seeing any new forms of sites coming out which are taking advantage of this technology?
Lots of sites. Oh, Andrew, you have no idea. I mean, I'm compiling.
Well, maybe we should talk about it next week. We'll put it on your blog or something. Yeah. We can all come and read about it.
Yeah. No, before you go, quick, Twitter.
Twitter.
Dodgeball.
Yeah, Dodgeball, yeah.
Jot. I love Jot. Love Jot.
Haven't been to Jot. Street. What's Jot?
Jot, basically, JOTT.com. In the States, you can, and this is open to your audience, but it will get there at some point. You basically have this phone number that you ring. It's a free call. And what it does is you ring up, you're driving along, and you go, I've got this great idea. And you're driving and you can't do anything about it. So you ring up this number and you say, hey, email me, Lydia at TikTok, this message. And then you say it. And what this thing does, what this service Jot does, is it translates it. And basically says, okay, voila, we'll type it up and send it to you in an email. So you get home, and there's your message on your computer. So you don't forget what you were thinking.
What will I think of next?
Don't you think it's great?
Oh, that's great.
Don't you think it's great?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, good for when you're lying in bed at night and you get a great idea at 3 in the morning. You can ring yourself up and leave a message.
Well, it's easier than getting out of bed and typing it up, don't you think?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt. Lydia, thank you very much for today. It's been lovely, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
It's been lovely. Goodbye.
And don't forget, you can go and ask Lydia questions on her blog if you want to find out about that at blogwell at wordpress.com. Next generation Wi-Fi is coming nearer. Are you excited about this, Graham?
Yes, should be rather good. This is the
802.11n,
the long awaited 108?
Thereabouts. It's just the new faster, ubiquitous, better wireless connectivity for your home networking.
Now this makes the wireless network around about as fast as the ubiquitous blue network cables that we've always had for
the Cat5, Cat6 data cables. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also means that people can still come in and surf on your system if you don't lock it down properly. But nonetheless,
yes, you still must get the security right.
Now the only major benefit I can see in that is for things like what Adam was talking about in his section where you can now use wireless devices to transfer media in real time off a hard drive and play it on your telly, because video has always been the big consumer of
it'll
bandwidth.
Be good for that, and it'll be fast enough to do broadband video over the wireless.
Yeah.
High definition video over the wireless, I mean. which the 54 meg might not have been quite fast enough.
Mm.
And the other thing is that, of course, with wireless, where you've got a group of people using one base station, which quite often happens, you've got three or four, half a dozen people connected to one base station.
Yep.
You don't get your own 100 megs like you do on the blue cables.
On the cable,
you get everybody shares the same 100 megs. So if you're sharing 100 meg instead of 50 meg, then you're obviously going to have more to go around.
Exactly. Now, this new standard is in draft form at the moment. There'll be boxes that will come out, which those who want to tinker with it can, but yep. It won't be ratified. That is put sort of like, here it is, we've finally figured it all out. It won't be ratified until 2009. So you can go out there and buy it. And there'll be devices that'll come out with 802.11n standards in it. So
There's devices out now that are doing their own in-house versions of the 100 meg or 108 meg wireless now. So the technology's out there and being trialled.
Yep, indeed. Now, Microsoft licensing threat to Linux. This was in the news this week too, and maybe you'll have something to say about this, Graeme. Microsoft has made its biggest challenge to open source software, including Windows rival Linux, claiming that such programs violate 235 Microsoft patents and saying it will seek licensing fees. Like, are we really clutching at straws here, Microsoft? Like, seriously?
Yes, they are. It's a bit of a funny one from Microsoft. I'm not quite sure what they're aiming for.
Well, don't forget, Microsoft did certainly get bitten on the proverbial the other day with their MP3 litigation. And
that fell in a big hole, didn't it?
Well, they ended up paying $1.75 billion US dollars or something to
Loosen. Yeah, certainly not the outcome they were originally looking for.
No. But seriously, like, Linux is open source. What possibly could they be... I don't understand this.
Well, this is one of the things. I don't think they've said anywhere exactly what patents that they're worried about. But presumably, there's technologies that they've put into Windows that people have adapted and put into the various Linuxes, and Microsoft believe that they've got the right to control those technologies or those innovations. But you'd think if they're in a stronger position than they are, that they might have said a bit more detail about what they're worried about.
Maybe so the marketing
they've
department.
Copped an awful lot of negative press about it too around the place,
and
a lot of people are saying that it's a fair amount of hot air on Microsoft's part.
Mm. Well, watch this space, and I'm sure something will transgress in the next few weeks. We'll see what happens, if anything at all.
It will be interesting to watch.
Could be just a storm in a teacup. When we return, the gadget and website of the week, not to mention the odd spot.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Listen up, it's Lydia here in Silicon Valley.
Tech Talk Radio's US correspondent Lydia Davis is offering listeners a chance to ask questions about blogging.
If you don't know the answer, I'll find out for you.
This is a great opportunity for people who are starting out in the world of blogging and why small businesses in particular would benefit from the Web 2.0 world. Visit Lydia's blog at blogwell.wordpress.com, or you can find the link on the Tech Talk Radio site. Go to the Tech Talk Radio tab on Blogwell and ask away. Fellow Aussies get preferential treatment. Take advantage of the fact that Lydia's also the marketing strategist for WebMama, one of Silicon Valley's biggest search engine optimization and search engine marketing firms. So why not hit her for some SEO help as well?
Come on, guys, let me have them.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
In this house, we obey the laws of thermodynamics!
Cool! Interesting and amazing!
Tech Talk Radio's Gadget of the Week.
Son of a...
This week's gadget is the world's smallest, apparently, Bluetooth headset.
Oh, yes.
You know those little... Star Trek-y things the people wear in their ears.
We need small Bluetooth gadgets because the big ones... Yeah,
they look a bit daggy, don't they?
Yeah, but the smaller they are, the easier they are to lose, I reckon.
Well, that's true. So developing a market there in replacements. This one's come from a company called Sound ID. It's called the Ear Module Bluetooth Headset.
Yep.
It's really small. It's absolutely tiny fitting in your ear. It's got some great features too. It sounds
good too.
Well, that's the thing. The sound quality features in it, that's all important.
You think small, you think it can't be that good.
Yeah, and it's got features for cancelling out background noise. So when and it's intelligent, though. So when you're on a call, it cancels out the background noise.
Oh, that's good.
But when you're not on a call, it enhances the outside noise so that your ear doesn't feel blocked up.
Oh,
so
that's
that you can
good.
Actually hear what's going on around you when you're not on a call.
So while you're driving a motor car and you think you're doing the wrong thing, you actually still hear the siren.
You can still hear what's going on around you. Apparently, even if you've got two of them and you and your friend have got one, you're on a motorbike or something, maybe, I don't know, and they will be able to talk to each other. So you can talk directly from one headset to the other.
So how much is the world's smallest headset, and can you get it in Australia yet?
Doesn't say on the blurb I've got whether you can get it in Australia, but
you get it by eBay
US,
or something.
Yeah, US $129.99.
That's not bad when you think about what Bluetooth headsets are worth
these days.
It's quite within the realms of small miniaturization. I wonder what sort of batteries these sorts of things use too. You never know, do you?
Here it is, everybody. The world's greatest website.
Tech Talk Radio website of the week.
Mark's got a website for the week. We spoke about it just before, didn't we?
Yes, we did, Andrew. It's called airdisaster.com. It's where I get a fair bit of my information and background and follow-ups from air disasters, airdisaster.com. With a bit of a caveat for empathy, the people who have gone through most of these air disasters have lost people or lost friends, and it's not a sensationalism, but just a way of following up and hopefully learning from others' mistakes and maybe avoiding them for the future.
Okay, and it's got a lot of interesting information about different air carriers, so if you're researching...
Definitely.
If you're nervous about a particular airline, unsure, or even just want to know someone's safety record, you can find that here, can you?
And knowledge is always power, and also the more you know about, the less may you worry in the future.
Okay.
Absolutely fascinating site.
How often do you frequent this? Is this one of the bookmarks?
It's one of my bookmarks. Yeah, I do my updates when I need to do some searching and information search.
Yeah, very good. All right, so the Tech Talk Radio website of the week, and by the way, we've won, we're the millionth visitor, so it's one of those sort of sites.
Just ignore the banner ads.
Yeah, exactly. The Tech Talk Radio website of the week is airdisaster.com.
There is a fine line between genius and madness.
Shoot. Missed it by that much.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Houston, we have a problem.
The Odd Spot on Tech Talk Radio.
One of the favourite parts of the week for me. Dr. Ron's not here because he normally comes up with some absolute pearlers. But tonight... All you young people out there that might be, plagiarising, ripping off a CD or something like that, stop and pay attention. A Sicilian man, 24, under house arrest, called police to take him to jail because he could not put up with the arguments his mother and stepfather were making. Marcello Lazzara, under arrest over counterfeit CDs, preferred to be arrested rather than stay at home with his family.
So the punishment was worse than he anticipated.
Oh, yes. Could you imagine that? He'd be up in little Lorenzo, be up in his room, and he'd be, pirating away and probably knocked off one of his friend's CDs.
And he got sentenced to spend time with the olds.
And his parents got stuck in him. Oh, I could just be a fly on the wall. You could hear it now, couldn't you?
They were saying, I can hear what you're doing in there.
Yes, exactly. But could you imagine wanting to be taken away because it got that bad? That's really...
Yes, I can.
Good. All right. That concludes Tech Talk Radio for this week. Mark, thank you for coming in and talking to us all about aviation and the likes.
Pleasure to be here, Andrew. Thank you for having me back, and look forward to seeing you next time. Yeah, hope you're feeling better.
I'm fine. We'll have to do it all again very shortly.
And
next week, we have an interview with the founder of WordPress.
Oh, really?
They turn 4 years old. And blogging is everything, as Lid is a testament to. So Lid caught up with the founder of WordPress on a pier, Pier 39, I think it was, in San Francisco.
Fantastic.
He took a little mini disc recorder down there and went and had a bit of a drink and all that sort of stuff with the boy. And we're going to hear that next week. And Dr. Ron will return. So stay tuned. You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. We've got... Graham Callaghan and Mark Mayer was in this evening. And till next week, bye for now.
Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists are Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins. Our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities are courtesy of Evolving Communications, podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The producers wish to thank all the stations that are taking the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM and 4KZ. For syndication, sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.